the issue relating to communication of activity that will follow that up. We've also been joined by another support staff member for this committee, and I wonder, I've just met her now through her department, and I wonder if you can introduce yourself but also give a little bit of a glimpse of who you are.
Thank you. My name is Mampaho Mudiba. As indicated, I'll be working as a researcher in this portfolio committee. In terms of my background, I come from an education background, and I could say that our teacher is looking at me because she knows me, and I'm very excited to be part of this team, and I'm going to also learn a lot from you, and I am at your service. Whenever you feel you have anything for me to do, I'm at your service. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Any other person that joined us? Then we can, excuse me. I'm not gonna give any comment on that. Can we then say that we will deal with the formal agenda by reflecting on the issue at hand, and then we will come to the minutes without us, Doctor.
I just wanted to convey our condolences to Mr. Kuza, a sad loss of a brother, and sudden loss of a brother.
Okay, that's noted. I think also, yeah, she just informed us earlier, and also I think member Gina is not well today. She was here yesterday. This morning as well. I think that's the only apology that I've got, Anela. Anyone else? Ms. Nelson and Mr. Mangena as well. So those apologies noted. Let me, by way of introduction.
Do mind you, I've got to run out to help at some stage, so you know I'm not.
Yeah, but the president and every political party did say that education is the issue in this country.
That's why I'm giving this the priority.
Okay. Thank you. Now we do take account of your difficulty. We've been in debate since last Thursday, the State of the Nation address, and clearly the critical issues that have emerged related to the focus on skills and education. And I thought that it's important that as we get into this year, that we get from the department what is the plans, what is the process, and what is the strategic initiatives being led to ensure that we massify that response to the president's call. And the State of the Nation's call around skilling our nation. We've talked a lot, and clearly now, as it also is announced that this is the year of action, we essentially want to hear what is the action that will be flowing. Our reality is unemployed people out there. Our reality is there's a skills mismatch. We know there's a reality around supply and demand, and we also know about the reality around people going through the system, basic education, schooling, But when they do get out of school, they can't always go to university. And hence, what is the responses? And this really is the department. DG, you've been there for just 2 or 3 months. You also know that you have to put together a new realigned department. But ours are to make sure that as Parliament, we ensure resilience in the context of delivery for our people. So I want to give it over to you, and if you can introduce the team as well.
Thank you, Chairperson. In fact, I'm the only person attending from the department. From the ministry, the minister's advisor, Greg Conde, is here.
Can I just have clarity? Would you be able to answer all of these questions, the two of you?
I anticipate that I'll be able to answer the questions. This is an area that I've been working in with the acting EDD and the two chief directors. If there are any questions I can't answer, then I'll forward answers.
Members, let me just say that I'm not comfortable if we are to proceed unless we are convinced that we're going to have a productive engagement. So I will get clarity from the members as well. My concern is if we are going to have the presentation, then it's going to be information download. But I thought we're going to get into some form of engagement and not only at the level of what mandates are and what not mandates are, but also at the level of actual operations. So as we're going to get into the engagement, I was really hoping that relevant officials dealing with NSF, relevant officials not dealing with the CETAs in CETAs, but the officials dealing with the CETAs operation in the department would essentially be I'm saying that I would be uncomfortable, but if there is a feeling that we need to get that presentation and engage, and possibly then at the end see how to proceed, we can do that. But this meeting was set out for a very thorough engagement when it comes to the CETA landscape and the skills development landscape. Members, any input on that point? Emma?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm equally uncomfortable if the relevant officials are not here who could actually help answer very pertinent questions that we have, particularly on CETAs, because it's an issue that I thought perhaps today we would actually hear something that will give us a direction, but if they're not here, really, it's going to create problems. Thank you.
Chairman, I'm willing to support the hypothesis, that is to say, that a faith in the DG, that she would be able to answer the questions, since she's the head of that department. And we are here, and because we have faith in officials to do what we think ought to be done, we should proceed.
Remember, it's not about faith. It's about actually getting into the details of these programs. So I'm putting that up front before the time. And because I think we've got unquestionable faith in the abilities of our Director General. Reality is we had a committee meeting. We want to deal with the operational detail down to the level of further detail, activities, etc. I think that's the issue at hand, yeah. Member Kubai? Yeah, sorry. Ms. Mashwana?
Thank you. I'm not trying to support anybody, but my hand was up to say what I want to say now, that the DG is here. And let's let's walk that mile, and as soon as we don't get the right answers, we say, hey, we that's where we stop. Because we cannot preempt that it will not happen. We must give it a chance. And if it's possible, we can agree on time frames. If we can get, if there's somewhere where she'll be stuck, I don't think she will be. We can agree that we need the answers written maybe by the end of the day, something like that. Thank you.
And Likuba.
Thanks, Chair. I think, firstly, just to say that I echo the sentiments shared by Chair. Perhaps maybe sending the message in future, we need to ensure, Tiki, that we have officials in the community. But again, it's just to actually even get to interact with even people who are there. It's common practice within Parliament. It's one of those practices that just depends, but you interact with other officials beyond the DG. We know it's the accounting officer. But Chair, I would suggest that we proceed. But I'm just also saying that the issue of why we start the meeting and then saying that we might not get the answers, it becomes uncomfortable. But we must just make sure that in future we have relevant people in the committee so that we don't end up thinking that we might not reach the overall objective of the meeting. So I would urge that we proceed because it's quite unacceptable to say if we can't get to the answers later, there would be some issue. The committee meeting should be able to deal with all the issues that are there and therefore get response. But I think let's proceed with the meeting.
So what we will do is we will continue and allow the DG to proceed. And then I think what we will then do, and I think members, if we can agree that we get the presentation say for 30 minutes, and that then we'll be able to get into the details, understanding that this was not the first time that we received a presentation on at least a mandate and the broad overview around the landscape. So the DG was also the one that made that presentation, so to be able to navigate through the presentation for the time process.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I came to the committee fully anticipating that I will be able to answer the questions. So I'm very happy that you've made a decision to proceed. This presentation, which I prepared yesterday, has not previously been made to the committee at all. So I am anticipating that I'll be able to explain the request, which was to look at the overview and mandate of the NSA, the overview and mandate of the CETAs. Some of that work has been previously presented, but the mandate will be covered very quickly, and I'll go straight into the analysis of the financial performance of all CETAs for this financial year. This item previously was reported at the last EXCO of the National Skills Authority, which I chair, and so I'm feeling fairly confident that I'm on top of those issues. The efficiency challenges in the National Skills Fund will be the fourth item. So if I can proceed with an overview of the NSA. You asked for an overview and the mandate. I think people are familiar with the composition. I have been chairing the NSA since the 1st of November. One of the things that we undertook in December was to have a strategic planning session, which was very well attended, together with some additional representation external to the NSA from structures that we felt could assist the NSA in reviewing its performance. Members are familiar with the fact that this is a constituency-based structure, that constituencies make nominations through NEDLAC, and that there are 5 members from Labour, from business, and from community. There's 5 members from different state departments, as well as from 5 members from skills providers. The minister also has discretionary appointments, and those are also made. The functions, if one looks at the Skills Development Act as amended, there's some very important functions here, and these have been the subject of some discussion and clarification between the department and the NSA. Fundamentally, the NSA advises the minister. Now, what that means is that the work of the department is reviewed
not only in terms of the oversight responsibility of Parliament, but there is also a stakeholder structure made up of the different constituencies, which is also advising the Minister in terms of skills strategy. It's very important to understand that, because the NSA is going to be looking at work that the department does around skills development policy, around skills development strategies, and about this strategic framework governing the NSF. And that advice to the minister from the department will be subject to further advice from the National Skills Authority. I think historically there may be some confusion in the public mind between what is executive and what is authority, advisory authority. And it's very clear in discussions with the NSA that they now understand that the executive authority is with the department and that they offer advice. They also are required in terms of the law to liaise with the CSIS, and they are busy in the action plan that we developed for the NSA this year, have a very clear framework of deadlines to report to the minister made, and report to the minister on their advice in terms of implementation of the strategy. We are agreeing that it's less their responsibility to conduct investigations and much more to advise the minister on investigations conducted by the department. And as a QCTO is established, which will be launched next week, they'll be also liaising with the QCTO. Now, one of the things that I think is very critical in terms of the functioning and the mandate of the National Skills Authority is that I've copied a section from the original legislation of the Skills Development Planning Unit. And what's critical in the way that the original Skills Development Planning Unit was conceptualized is that it would do research and analyze the labor market in order to assist with the formulation of national skills development strategies and sector skills development and provide information to the National Skills Authority. In fact, that was never fully established. And it has meant that in our review of the National Skills Authority, they have not had sufficient capacity to properly advise the minister up until this point. And that is now being redressed. So if the summary is to advise the minister in policy and strategy, to liaise with CSIS, report to the minister, and to oversee the NSF, as well as receive information. What we've decided to do after the December strategic planning is that we have to strengthen the NSA because it has to perform its advisory functions. It's quite clear that the alignment between the human resource development strategy of South Africa and NDS has to be taken forward, both in terms of content of both of those quite critical policy instruments. And there also has to be a structural linkage between the Human Resource Development Council, which is going to be launched on the 30th of March, and the National Skills Development and the NSA. The minister is in the process of signing a letter for the new NSA chair, who's going to be appointed in time for the meeting tomorrow, and the minister will make that announcement. So the new NSA chair will co-chair with me tomorrow, and I will then step down from being the chair of the NSA, and the new chair will continue. It was also agreed, and this hasn't been the case before, that the NSA should indeed have its executive officer, which should be a special dedicated post and not be subsumed into the role of the DDG, as was previously the case in the Department of Labor. So the NSA will tomorrow approve a draft job description, after which we will advertise and correct. That's the NSA, and I think that in terms of your request that we provide an overview of the mandate, I've done that. In terms of the overview and mandate of the CSIS, again, I start by looking at the legal functions of the CSIS. And the legal functions of the CSIS are consistent with the responsibilities of the Skills Development Act. Firstly, it's got to develop a sector skills plan within the framework of the National Skills Development Strategy. You'll see in the performance reviews of the CSIS that this is done unequally and evenly across the CSIS. But then they must implement the sector skills plans by establishing learning programs, improving workplace skills planning, allocating grants, and monitoring the skills development policy in the sector by the QCTO. That was previously a function of the CSIS, but their quality assurance function has now shifted to the QCTO. In terms of promoting learning programs, that includes learnerships, and you will know that from the amendments to the Skills Development Act, that there's now a special function in terms of artisan training. So they, the CETAs identify workplace and support the development of learning materials, improving the facilitation and assisting in the conclusion of the agreement. This is a very important function in terms of us creating closer linkages between workplace learning programs and formal qualifications to public institutions, and a great deal of work is happening around that. The CETAs also do liaise with the National Skills Authority in terms of the development policy and the development strategy and the sector skills plan. So, for example, in the year plan for the National Skills Authority, we are proposing that in the April meeting of the authority, we will table the National Skills Development Strategy, as well as the proposals around the realignment of the CETAs. And then what will be presented to the meeting of the authority tomorrow is that there's an intensive program of both sectoral and levels within the sector's consultation around the National Skills Development Strategy, which will include liaison with the CETAs, because we want the CETAs to look at the sectoral components of that National Skills Development Strategy. The CETAs are also financially accountable in terms of budget report strategic plans, which happens through the Office of the DG. In terms of the establishment of the CETAs, I think everyone's aware that they were established for a period of 5 years. In 2005, the first 20 were established, and the CETAs have been established to last until March 2010, when the Minister took responsibility for the skills legislation on the 1st of November. The first thing he did was to meet with CETA chairpersons and CEOs and to inform them that he was going to extend the period of establishment of the CETAs until the end of the next financial year, so that we could be absolutely sure that in terms of the strategies of the National Skills Development Strategy, that the functions of the CETAs would be developed in alignment with that. So we have extended the current NSDS2 until the end of the next financial year. We've extended the life of the CETAs, and in the next few months we're going to be doing the work so that we have a new skills development strategy, that we have a new CETA landscape, so that people can do the necessary restructuring that will be required in order for them to complete their service levels agreement for 2011-2012. The important thing about the functioning of the CETAs in terms of your request that we look at the mandate is that members are reminded that the 23 CETAs cover all of the economic sectors, and we use standard industrial classification codes for that. And that's a fundamental organizational framework for the CETA landscape, and if that was to be changed or consolidated anywhere in the new landscape, that would be a key concept that would need revision. So the responsibilities include managing stakeholder relations with the constituency-based structure of the CETA boards, to develop the plans, to establish priorities, to make sure that the mandatory grants and annual reporting are in place, as well as doing the discretionary grants that are in line with the National Skills Development Strategy. Historically, they've also looked at quality of learning in the workplace, but this will increasingly be taken place through the QCTO. In terms of the legislation, the CETAs have to prepare service levels agreements. Those have now been received for the next financial year. They have to look at the CETA performance, their business plan, and anything that the department needs to know in terms of what they are doing to improve their functions. If the DG and the CETA can't agree on the contents of the service level agreement, then the minister has to determine the contents of the service level agreement. I think I have it in the presentation, but I have previously raised with the committee that we're proposing that this committee also engages with the sectors that are in other portfolio committees to ensure that those service levels agreements meet the parliament is brought into that process to the extent that your process is allowed. So for the next financial year, we've had meetings, we've given them a framework which requires some alignment to government priorities within the framework of the National Skills Development Strategy. All of these have now been received, and we're in the process of reading them. And I can indicate that they are an uneven quality, although it's premature to give any more information on that. In terms of the analysis of financial performance of all teachers, there has been detailed work that's done in terms of the limited time that is for presentation. I focused on the information is there, but I focused on the teachers that are particularly struggling. Just to sketch the framework for members, the Skills Development Act does allow the minister to issue a written instruction if a teacher is not complying, if it's not performing its functions, if that membership is no longer compliant, if it isn't in accordance with the equity plan. So if we look at the performance of CETAs in the last financial year, most of the CETAs have in general met their proof criteria in terms of their SLAs, but some have underperformed. The program for CETA coordination is managing this underperformance in terms of the relevant requirements. In terms of the analysis of the financial performance for the financial year 2008-2009, which is the last year that's formally been reported on, those have all been tabled in Parliament, and I'm sure different members are familiar with different elements of that in some detail. The CETAs have indicated that some of the, in their financial statements, that some funds have been allocated to projects and to be rolled over to the next year, if that's approved by Treasury. Treasury has some concerns about whether or not we should be allowing that rollover, and that has been taken up in discussion with the relevant CETAs and with Treasury. That may result in amendments to legislation. In terms of the performance of specific CETAs, as indicated in preparing this presentation, we decided to focus on four CETAs that have received a disclaimer or a qualification on their financial management for the last financial year, and those are for the E-CETA, P-CETA, the CETA and the MAP-CETA, the construction CETA and the MAP-CETA, and I want to take them one by one. For the E-CETA, the energy CETA, the CETA failed to submit the annual report by the required date. The Auditor General issued a disclaimer for the 2008-09 financial year. The Auditor General was unable to determine the current accuracy, completeness, and classification of the money used, which is very serious. NES is requesting a response or a program of action regarding that non-compliance was sent to the CETA's chairperson. In terms of the P-CETA, which is a public service CETA, it's had governance and leadership problems since inception. I've met with the previous DG for the public service on this matter, and this needs to be taken forward with the new acting DG of the DPSA. The Minister has issued a Section 14A instruction and required that the CETA address a number of governance issues in order to ensure compliance, but the CETA again failed to submit the annual report by the required date, and a disclaimer was issued. So we have requested a program of action to the CETA's chairperson. The CETA chairperson has the executive, the CEO of the CETA has changed twice in recent months, and we are discussing the P-CETA with the department, and this is clearly a sector where there would need to be discussion with the relevant portfolio committee. In terms of the construction CETA, the Auditor General again issued a qualification for the financial year, and areas identified were on the basis of housing difficulties, uncertainties, unauthorized expenditure, irregular, fruitless, wasteful expenditure, and the letter requesting a response and the program of action was sent to the CETA's chairperson. The CETA appointed a new governing board in March, and they're in the process of developing that. The MAP CETA, the board suspended the chairperson during 2009 because there were a whole string of allegations levelled against him. There were two investigations with slightly different conclusions presented to the board, and we are now, as DHET, conducting an investigation into the allegations. Financially, there was a qualification for the 2008-09 financial year, and the CETA has exceeded its 10% administration budget. It's failed to remain below the prescribed 10% ever since it was established, even though the CETA board now says that they're going to comply. So we've sent a letter requiring a response regarding the non-qualification. What I also did is to look at the audit performance for the last 4 years, from 2005-06 to 2008-09, and you'll see that the C2, we don't have the, well, I didn't have the detailed information because it's managed by the DPSA, the administrative function is managed by the DPSA. But for the construction CETA, energy CETA, and MAP CETA, you will see that it's a constant stream of qualifications and disclaimers and an adverse opinion. So the decision that we've taken is that we're going to be using the legislation to address non-performance. Investigations are currently underway, and we will be providing advice to the minister to act in terms of the following options. And the options that are on legislation are three. The minister, in terms of underperformance, can amalgamate two or more CETAs after consulting with the NSA. Obviously, that's an interim management possibility and mustn't be confused with the restructuring of the CETA landscape. I think the principal position that we've taken is that we're not going to be managing the restructuring of the CETA landscape in order to deal with difficulties. But it does mean that if there's a small CETA that isn't coping, it may be better to have it managed by another CETA. And that may be one of the recommendations that we make to the minister. The section 15, well, let me start with section 14, is that the question of issuing written instructions and then withholding the levy is an option that can be considered. But section 15 is that we may, after consultation with the NSA and the CETA in question, appoint an administrator to perform all of the functions. That would also be a very serious consequence. But if one looks at the years of non-performance, you can see that our recommendation is that urgent action is needed. The MAP CETA is the Performing Arts CETA, Media and Performing Arts. What I think is important to note is that the NSA subcommittee has also considered these reports and is recommending the recommendation that's going to the NSA meeting tomorrow is that the advice that will be going to the minister is that he should be taking action with regard to these poorly performing CETAs. So in terms of the legal options, ducks are in a row. To proceed. Chairperson, I know that I'm probably over time already, but in fact your request to come asked us to cover four large issues. So if you'll allow me to proceed, you asked us to deal with efficiency challenges in the National Skills Fund. Basically, the National Skills Fund was established in 1998, and in 1999 it took over the PAC Fund. And it received its first levies in 2000. It received the mandate that governs the disbursement of the Skills Development Fund is given to the National Skills Development Strategy. So the National Skills Development Strategy 1, which was adopted in 2001, the National Skills Development Strategy 2, that was adopted in 2005, provides the framework through which the funds in the National Skills Fund are dispersed. NSDS2 has been extended from 2005 to 2009 into 10-11, as I indicated previously, but we have requested from the NSF and from the CETA compliance with some of the new strategic priorities of government. The Skills Development Act indicates that it has key obligations which in relation to the use of the money and land policy frameworks, control and administration of the fund, and it must conform to requirements of the PMFA as well as reporting to the NSA. So the use of the fund is primarily three things. Firstly, it funds projects identified in the National Skills Development Strategy and National Priorities. It can also fund projects related to the purpose of the Act as the DP determines, and the practice that we're taking forward is that normally there's some consultation with the NSA in terms of projects that fall within the purpose of the Act. And then there is also the issue of the NSA funding its own activities, and the administration of the NSF within prescribed limits. Before the amendments to the legislation in 2008, the limit was 2%. There is now, with the amendment to the legislation, the possibility of the DG determining a higher percentage of the NSF to fund the costs of the operations of the Skills Development Act at a level higher than 2%, and we're preparing regulations in that regard rather urgently, because our understanding is that some of the advice from the Auditor General to the Department of Labor was that there were functions of the NSF that were being funded from the tax-based fiscus, which should in fact be funded by the NSF. And as we take forward the building of the capacity of regional officers supporting the work of the NSF, it's likely that we're going to need to fund that from the NSF. Just in terms of control and administration, the DG is the accounting officer, we have ensured that with the transition from the Department of Labor, that the acting CFO of the Department of Higher Education and Training is very carefully monitoring the fund, that the financial authority for the fund is still located within the Department of Labor, whose DG is the accounting officer up until the end of this financial year. So from 2010-11, the DG HIT will be the accounting officer and will make sure that we control and keep proper records and prepare the annual financial statements. One of the things that we are going to be taking forward in order to build the capacity of the National Skills Fund is we are going to appoint an executive officer. At the moment, it's run by a chief director, and we think that the efficiency challenges within the National Skills Authority are such that we need to bring higher level capacity to make sure that the fund functions efficiently. Clearly, members know that it's got to be managed in accordance with the PFMA, and the NSA does advise, as I indicated earlier, the Minister on the strategic framework. Key challenges for the NSF is firstly the alignment with priorities of the Department of Higher Education and Training in terms of this new department, which has responsibility of aligning skills policies and strategies and development framework with human resource development strategy for the country, as well as using the providers of education and training to use this massive resource of the Skills Development Levy to achieve the purposes of the Act. In looking at how the NSF has been operating, we have been very concerned about the capacity, the efficiencies, and the internal institutional processes and mechanisms of the fund. It seems absurd to us that there's a backlog in terms, apart from the difficulties with the transition from the Department of Labor, it seems absurd to us that the fund is not operating much more efficiently, much more effectively, with a much higher turnaround, using much more modern mechanisms in terms of processes. There should be a much stronger IT base for the management of those processes, and we've requested that expertise be brought in to look at the processes so that they become more functional. The other challenge is after the conclusion of the national macro reorganization of the state is that we are left without provincial capacity to do the work of the NSF on the ground, and there's urgent work happening to use the additional administrative component of the fund to establish provincial capacity. So we are forging greater alignment with DHET priorities, particularly looking at capacity challenges and quality challenges within the FET system, including the COSI project, and also looking for opportunities for high-impact delivery around job creation. We're going to address institutional limitations by reviewing grant allocation mechanisms and reviewing the grant support systems. Going to appoint a CEO, make sure that CEO takes responsibility for the strategic plan in improving efficiencies, which will require some increased capacity, as well as improving and modernizing systems. We have to deal with the underspending. I think cumulatively the underspending of the NS, of the National Skills Fund is a huge problem when we have such huge skill backlogs to address. So we're going to be looking very carefully at partnerships and grant intermediaries. Chairperson, I believe that took a little bit longer than half an hour, but thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, TG. It was quite thorough. Let's get back into the discussions, and I think what we want to do is we would want to start with the NSA presentation, and then possibly deal with questions around that, move on to the CETA landscape and then the NSF. Obviously, there's interrelatedness in all of them, so I would allow taking into account that, but if there's specific questions regarding those three areas, we'll start it in that way. I'm not seeing hands at this point. Member.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Two questions, maybe they're clarification questions. The issue of the Chairperson didn't comply and the letter written to him. I'm checking if there's an instrument put in place for non-compliance. Or if somebody does not comply, then they just get a letter. That's the first one. And the second one, I note that some of the functions will be to the identification of workplace places for practical experience, which is good. But will this lead to some sort of commitment from, say, you see, if I come to your center and do things practically, I hope to get a job at the end of the day. Because this government is depending on CETA. To train skills so that people must be trained so that they end up working. I'm just checking if there are any liabilities or some people are bound. If you go there and do practical, you know, sure that at the end of the day, you'll be employed there. Thanks.
Member Namo.
Thank you, Chairperson. DG, many times when we talk about skilling people, the inclination is towards the able-bodied persons. And I want to find out to what extent do people with disabilities actually benefiting from national skills development and actually accessing it as they should. Because I think, according to the Constitution, the rights are rights for all people, irrespective of disability. And secondly, it is a known fact that CETAs in general are underperforming. They do not actually produce skills required by the South African market, mainly because they are not located in the industry where they actually belong. Is there any intention to relocate CETAs to the industry? And if not, can the DG then explain the reasons? Thanks.
Member Vukuza.
Thank you, Chair. I'm understanding the DG to be saying she is responding to questions. That already, so maybe then, I don't know if mine won't be a wish list beyond the questions, because I just think that one would have, well, it being a year of action, I'm sure the year of analysis is gone. Of course, we need analysis, but it's a year of action. And so to a certain extent, I think I understand the chair's sentiment to the mandates and so on. Of course, we need to understand that. DG1 would have been so curious to see the CETA landscape, all of it, without having to cherry-pick necessarily the four non-performing CETAs, to see the total landscape of the 23 CETAs and how they have performed against the outputs where they come from. Because I do understand that now, in the migratory process of the CETAs, you're at border gates, and that is why you are borrowing yet a year to be able to reconfigure the CETAs. This is my understanding. So, but what is the landscape? What does it look like? What is the health of the CETAs? And what will be different when SITAs are under the higher education department than they were. Of course, these are questions for reflection and obviously for projecting. But again, taking on SITAs without probably for the purposes of the committee, the SWOT analysis, what is wrong with these SITAs? Why should we have them? Why should we not have them? What is weak and strong, and what do we desire them to do? And what was the original intention? Did they do that? Did they fail? What are we going to do? Is it just a migratory structural process? What about the original outputs and outcomes of the SITAs? What happened to that? I'm very curious about that. Obviously, the issues of internal controls for me are quite key in terms of governance issues. What happened to the CEOs and the people that were accountable to the failures of the SITAs? What did we do to them to the extent that it becomes a lesson and a benchmark in terms of internal control to those that are going to be taking after them? I'll rest my case for now. Thanks.
I think another proposal is just telling some of my points here, because I also wanted to also make follow-ups in terms of what happened to the accounting officers that were there before. Because it will really point a very bad habit that people that were also accountable, but they can still not be able to account it at the current moment. But also I wanted to check what is the cooperation that you're also getting after the previous experience that you had with the DG from Labour at the current moment? What is the relation? Are they able to at least soften up to be able to assist you in terms of able to progress in terms of these issues? You know, if you can be able to get clarity in terms of that. But well, lastly, when do you anticipate to appoint the CEO for NSF? Because I'm just looking at time that, you know, you've got these plans that you also want to, you know, move ahead with it. But if we delay in terms of appointing, we're able also to have challenges in them. So that's, what is the time frame in terms of ensuring that it is all in the right place and everything starts go? Because I think those are one of the issues that you must be able to do. Because when you say you must just be ensure that as Parliament, we ensure that if this is the year of action, we really produce action. We don't just have this analysis and this projection that you also have, but you also have something that you can say, at this particular time, we have been able to produce what we always anticipate to have. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. I'm also dealing with all the issues now. Okay. Just firstly, then, I just wanted to ask you on the first issue around NSA. I understand that you currently the acting chair until tomorrow, but I didn't understand the reasons why there was no chair. Why do you end up with you acting until you have just get a clarity on that one? Where is the chair? What has happened before you arrived and all those things? Secondly, on the issue of status, according to its mandate and the legal functionality, I think I echo sentiments around the colleagues, what they are raising. And that's why we need to just find some time to deal with issues of status in detail. With the CTS themselves, that's what I'm trying to say, Chair. Maybe just call the CTS, the CEOs, so that we can try and engage. I would have preferred that they are here. For example,
maybe goodbye. We've got until 12:30, okay. And we've got 2 hours left, so we're going to deal with the issue.
Okay. The issue that I want to understand is around the monitoring of WSP and ACR within the institution themselves. Because what you find is that legal function is they need to be submitted, but we have a tool across all sectors to monitor all the sectors that all the WSPs and ATR are received by this institution. And out of that, how regular do we have that analysis in terms of checking what are the scarce need or what is required by the market, and the, that link of the reports and what needs to be put in place and the support thereof, so that as well when we do the transfers of funds, you don't continue to pump money into a sector where there are no needs specifically, because my understanding is that when there's regularly reports from the sectors, from the employers to say, these are our needs, you find that that will vary. I'm sort of linking it to your funding models of the sectors, that issue. That's the first one on the sector. Sorry. The second one, Chair, it's again to say, the sectors themselves, yes, I understand the four that are reflected here, but there's been a report of a number of sectors. For example, I'll make an example of one, tourism sector. Constantly, I think since it has been in inception, it has had almost six CEOs. That can be a healthy sector. You have health and welfare sector, that for some time, the industry itself, there's been non-compliance, there's been issues. So I'm just raising that to say, I understand perhaps maybe the requirement could have been around financial, but my understanding is that if we actually evaluate the performance of the sectors, if we are to evaluate the performance of the sectors, we'd also check its effectiveness, its responding to the mandate, not only around the finances, how they account on finances. The other issue around NSF, I'm trying to understand the reason why the department would want to employ a CEO. Are we anticipating that we change the mandate or the legislative requirement to say that the DG becomes the accounting officer, therefore the CEO would become the accounting officer? At what level? Because sometimes the issue might not be that we needed somebody at the CEO level, depending on at the level that you put it in terms of the structures of government. But if we are to acknowledge that, okay, the current chief director, directory, does not function to the level that is expected because it's undercapacitated, therefore we need to put capacity in this place, increase it to a DDG level that accounts to the DG, whereby the DG still becomes an accounting officer. I have a bit of a challenge or a problem to understand why I would want to convert that post into a CEO, not within the department and accounting to the DG, therefore the DG becoming the overall accounting officer in terms of that fund and its management. But lastly, Chair, is to say currently, just trying to understand what is happening out there in terms of the fund, the National Skills Fund. What is the outlook? Are employers, trainers getting the necessary funds, getting the necessary support, even during this transition? I understand you spoke about the need to increase spending capacity to ensure where are we sitting now, what are the issues that are there, so that we understand. I mean, there are a number of people who want to understand, they have not been able to get that access of the funds. What is the current strategy while you are putting these mechanisms in place, so that the delivery of those outcomes, the delivery of the skills and that we need to intervene on, is not compromised. Thanks.
Member Makvela.
Thanks, Chair. This is some of the questions will just be very direct for us to know. One would relate to the skills development planning unit. Is it in place? I know it's indicating that you've got responsibility to establish it, but is it in place as we speak? And the second will be the alignment process between the human resource development strategy and the national skills development one. What process is there? When are we seeing that realignment? So that it's not something that is there for forever. This particular problems about the financial statement. For the period of 3 years or so, there's been quite a problem. Is that done in-house or is it outsourced in terms of auditing? What are the issues there? There's also talk about significant uncertainties in, I think, on the CCPA. What does it mean? You see, there's a regular or wasteful expenditure, but there's one that's significant uncertainties. What could be the issue? My understanding is that the chairperson who suspended is not necessarily full time, but that may not be the issue. I want to understand the relationship between that suspension and the financial statement. Is it related to that, or what could be the issue? Service level agreement, which are signed each year when the situation is as bad as this. What was happening? Because by the end of every financial year, you sign a new service level agreement, but the situation does not seem really to be changing. Is it just specifically on finances or even broadly on the other issues that are covered or aspects that are covered by the SLAs? The other is about the effectiveness of the SITA boards. You know, because if they're there, but you're continuing to have all these problems, there's general outcry in the country. But there are boards that are supposed to be taking charge in that kind of a situation. What gets to happen there? On another dimension, the appointment of the executive officer who should be within the public service. What does it mean? Does this person get seconded then to that, or it's up? Yeah, I think you're getting there were concerns at some point about these trainings taking place, that you often have same people trained on the same thing year in, year out. So the impact wasn't reaching out to many in certain areas or on specific sitters. Is the review able to show such kind of things, or are able statistically to tell that since this is the number of people we might have been able to cover? The very last one, it's about the mandate. It's on page 12. Roman figure 4. Will you take it from B there to saying it should be, one of those will be to implement its sector skills plan by? 4 says monitoring education and skills development provision in the sector by that qualification authority, or quality one, on occupations and trade. Is it not the other way around, or you can just unpack for one to understand it? Because I thought, as it's captured, perhaps it may not be communicating what it's supposed to communicate.
The last two people before we get responses.
I just have two very brief questions, Chair. The first is whether the DG is satisfied that everything has been done in order to deal with the delinquent sitters. My first question. And the second question is whether it's possible for the department to use some of the funds in the National Skills Fund to finance FET colleges, and what the limits are to doing that.
Okay, John.
Thank you, Chair.
Let me thank the DG for the presentation. Mine are very short questions. We are talking about these institutions, the National Skills Authorities. Where are they? Where are they located in the country? Where are their physical offices? And you talk about 23 cities. Where are they? Do you know where these institutions are located? Lastly, you are presenting a document that the Department of Higher Education is somewhere in South Africa. But you are not saying where. For me, it's important that as we talk here, I should know exactly when you live there, where to find you. Your document probably should be standard to say Department of Higher Education, give us the physical address and the contact number where you can be found in terms of follow-ups. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks.
Open for another round.
Those very engaging questions. I'm going to have a great deal of fun in replying to them. It's a really long list, Susan, and I'm feeling a little bit anxious that as I go back to number one after number 11, if I'm really going to remember in detail, and I wonder if in future we can take about 5 questions at a time. But the first question, which I think was from you, is about who was the first question, about the issue of compliance and CETA's link to job opportunities.
Yeah.
It was you. Okay, it helps me remember when I can look at the person. The question of compliance, the legislation is quite clear, and I'm sure that the Portfolio Committee has, within the files that people use to monitor the work, does keep a list, I mean, does keep a copy of the skills legislation. And I think it's very important in terms of several of the questions that we go back to that legislation to understand the powers of the minister. The CETAs have their own CEOs who are their accounting officer. They have their own governance structures, which is the boards of the CETAs. Whether or not we need, over the course of the next year, to look at the legislation governing the boards, and so there's stronger possibilities of intervention, is something that the committee will give us advice on. But in terms of the functioning, the minister has very clear responsibilities in the legislation. Firstly, the finances of the CETA are covered in the legislation. It gives the CETA's very clear responsibilities in terms of what they must do with the money in terms of banking accounts, the ways in which that money can be used, the percentage of the money that can be used on administration or on other related issues relating to salaries, and that it must be managed in terms of the PFMA. If there is non-compliance, the minister can firstly issue a written instruction, and the written instruction has to give the reason why the instruction has been set up, the provision of the act that the CETA is not complying with, and the steps that the CETA must take in order to comply. So it's a very specific letter. If the CETA feels that the length of time is not enough, it can request a longer period of time to comply. But then, if the minister is not satisfied that the instruction has been followed, he then can withhold the money, effective closure, invoke the administration of Section 15, which allows us to take over the functioning of the CETA, can do further investigations into management administration if the answers are not satisfactory, and take any other steps that are necessary. So I want to just, in answering that question, pick up another couple of related questions. Are we satisfied that, and I think that's with a question from Uma Jens, that enough's been done? Our view is that if you look at the poor performance over 4 years of these five particular shooters, it is time now to act. And we want to act decisively. So the detailed investigations are happening in order for the minister to issue final written instructions, after which we wish to act. I think one of the things that's been useful conceptually in an engagement with the National Skills Authority is that the wording of the legislation has, I think, slightly muddied the waters, because you'll see when I went through the legislation that we said that and they can investigate. And in fact, the law gives them the NSA the authority to actually go in and investigate. But that confuses executive and advisory. And we're saying it's executive responsibility to act and the NSA to advise about whether we did the right thing. And the previous muddying of the waters, I think, may have slowed down the response. The second thing that I need to reply to the first question is the question of the linkages between CETAs and job opportunities. And again, I'm going to try and pick up some of the related questions here. I think that there is a great deal of confusion about the functions of the CETAs in the public discourse. One of them is that the CETAs are training institutes, and they're not. They don't train, nor should they train. Other institutions, public and private, do the training. Okay, so that's the first thing. They don't provide job opportunities, but they must facilitate job opportunities. And indeed, if I can just make an aside here to the question about the year of action. When we present the budget and the ideas that are about the year of action, I'm going to really enjoy responding in more detail. But that was not the request for this meeting. It wasn't to ask us about our plans. It was to explain what these bodies are doing. So in terms of the year of action, the role of the CETAs in linking qualification opportunities to job opportunities, you're going to see that there's wonderful work happening. And we're very excited about that. That's not the purpose of today, and it will happen when we present strategic plans, when we present budget. But CETAs don't create job opportunities necessarily, other through the... Okay, so let me just get back to what CETAs do. CETAs are constructed as advisory structures and authorities in terms of what needs to be done in the particular sector. It's a sectoral education and training authority. So if you look at the CETA, I mean a CETA such as tourism or health and welfare, what it does is it brings employees and unions, labor, and government into one organization to say, what are the challenges within the sector for training, which links to your question about skills needs. What are the workplaces? What's the assessment on the research done in this sector about what are the skills needs? What are the scarce skills needs? What are the critical skills needs? What are the skill needs to promote broad social inclusion? So within a sector of the economy, it looks at what training needs to happen. A significant proportion of that work is derived from work-based skills programs, but the work-based skills programs is an inadequate mechanism to give us all of the information we need about scarce skills, which is where the work of the CETAs has to link to the human resource development strategy. So if you look at, for example, the Ngezi report, which does a review of the functioning of the different CETAs, you'll see that of the 23 CETAs, not all of them are providing reliable information on scarce and critical skills. So HRDSA, in developing an analysis of scarce and critical skills, needs to be engaging with each CETA to see if that performance of their function is based on rigorous mechanisms. And if it isn't, we need through the HFDRC and the CETA to work out what's needed. So that's one of the linkages. The next question in terms of skilling in relation to able bodies and disability is that part of the National Skills Development Strategy 2 has set specific targets for disability for each of the CETAs. So CETAs report their service levels agreement, their commitments in terms of reaching disability within that sector, and their annual report against performance for disability. So as this committee accumulates a library of CETA reports, you'll be able to look at each CETA and performance against the target for disability that's been set in the National Skills Development Strategy. And you'll also be able to look at performance against disability for the National Skills Fund. So that question is a critical question. It's part of the transformatory project of this country, and you need to be reviewing it in engagement with every CETA because the targets are set. The issue that I want to address now for the second question is the question of the general underperformance of CETAs. And again, this is part of the broad public discourse around sectors that I must say prior to my joining the department I might also have been guilty of generally underperforming CETAs. In fact, one of the reasons that we are so determined to deal with CETAs that have been consistently underperforming is because in our view, that muddies the water. It creates a cloud about CETAs because there are some problems. In fact, there's many CETAs that are performing excellently. And I know, I don't know if you're going to allow me in terms of time, and you might want to say that you'd like me to submit this in writing, which I'll be very happy to do. But if I now take each of the CETAs, I can give you an analysis in terms of their performance, in terms of governance, in terms of fund management, general performance, and where we're going with them. Would you like me to do that? Okay. In terms of the EC, I can give a document. I'll have to. I can send it through afterwards. But I will, before the budget vote this afternoon, send the committee secretary an analysis of each of the CETAs in terms of the governance, fund management, performance in general. And you will see that there's many CETAs that are behaving in exemplary fashion. Excellent work being done. When we deal with the full non-performing CETAs that are consistently non-performing, I think it will create an environment where other sectors that are performing will be treated with the respect that they deserve. Okay? Which is not to say everything's perfect. I'll never be a person who says that everything is perfect. I'll come back to the particular CETAs that accept that I'll be able to deal with it now. So, for example, there was a question about the health and welfare CETA. And we do know that since a new CEO has been appointed, the performance in terms of NSDS targets and the general performance has hugely improved. So you'll be pleased to know that. The health and welfare CETA financial statements for 2008 and 2009 were fairly presented. There were some reservations from the Auditor General, but there was definitely an improvement. So whilst the performance of the CETA has been below expectations, now that there's a new CEO, there's signs of clear improvement, and that's the monitoring that's happening. So if I proceed to the next question from the second set, the third question from the second questioner, is there was a concern that perhaps the CETAs don't necessarily produce skills because they're not located in the industry they belong in, and I need to explain that. It's basically the CETA geographically will be located in different offices, and I will provide a list of all of the addresses and the phone numbers of all of the CETAs today to the portfolio committee. The CETAs is simply that body that serves a particular industry, but the trainers for the skills are not the CETA, and they should be located close to industry in various ways. Number one, if the FET colleges are a critical provider of the qualifications, it's the responsibility of the FET college to have a close and dynamic relationship with industry so that the college is supplying qualifications that are responsive and relevant to industry needs. If it's a learnership or an artisan program where the practical training and the workplace component is located in the industry, then it's also for the CETA to ensure that the resources that it gives to the sector are responsive to industry. So they are sectorally relocated in industry, but the point is taken that they need to be strong industry linkages. The CETA landscape question was your question, it's the third questioner, is what is the landscape? That will come because you'll get the overview, and I think your question will then be answered, and it will also give you the sense of which are the weak and which are the strong. If one looks at the documents that have been done to review the CETA landscape, you'll see that some of the CETAs are stronger than others in terms of the resource base. There's some CETAs that are functioning very well, but they have a weak resource base. So, for example, the agricultural CETA is a strongly performing CETA, but it has a really weak income base because it gets 1% of the personnel budget of all companies over a particular size. There's one or two industries that dominate. But, in fact, to reach the agricultural needs of all agricultural workers in that sector, the resource base is not strong enough. And that will be one of the factors that does inform us as we take forward the restructuring process. Okay. I think the question of the accounting officer might have been your question. And I just need to remember in my head the four questions that you had within them. The Department of Labor has signed a protocol, a service level agreement, as was required in the medium term budget policy statement that was tabled by the Minister of Finance in October, which specifies what are the functional responsibilities of the DG of Labor and the functional responsibilities of the DG of Higher Education and Training. Clarity was sought from the state legal advisor as to the content of that service level agreement prior to it being signed. The committee, if it wishes to have a copy of the service level agreement, I would advise that you receive it, and if there's any further requests for advice from the state law advisor, you're welcome to receive. I'll be happy to forward that as well. But that makes it absolutely clear where the functional responsibilities lie. And it is the leadership of the administration of the legislation in terms of the functions, and any performance in relation to the law. The responsibility from the 1st of November is the Minister of Higher Education and Training. But Vote 15 remains the functional responsibility of the DG of Labour, and all staff who perform the functions for which Minister Nzimande are responsible are still within the Department of Labour. They work closely with us. We work with them on a daily basis. But for any career incidents, their salaries, the Department of Labor. I know that it's been complex, and I think that's why it's taken so long to resolve. But it may help the committee if you get a copy of the service level agreement and the legal advice, if that's what you need. The service level agreement was signed 2 weeks ago. Okay, the next question was appointing a CEO for the NSFAS. If I can just indicate that this is what the law provides for. It's not a new idea. So if you look in Chapter 7 of the Skills Development Act, Clause 29D, says in terms of the Control 1D, the Control Administration of the Fund, the DG is the accounting officer and must, subject to laws governing the public service, appoint the executive officer of the NSF who will, upon such appointment, be an employer of the public service. So it's required in law. What's happened previously, prior to us, thank you very much, deciding to appoint an advertiser CEO, is that the Department of Labor managed both the executive officer of the NSA and the executive officer of the NS, National Skills Fund, by saying there's a person in the Department of Labor with pre-existing functions who will take on this function as well. And we think that that has blurred the responsibility and limited capacity. So previously, the DDG of Skills in the Department of Labor was told he must also be the executive officer of the NSA. So it meant that the NSA would report to the DDG, who would be the EE, to minister. We're saying we want a little bit of separation. We see the NSA as overseeing the department and providing advice to the minister. You can't advise the minister the very person who you are commenting on. So that's why we're going to have an executive officer. And the same for the National Skills Fund. National Skills Fund, I think it's not a secret that it's way behind in terms of its spending. There's no secret that it's been hugely inefficient. So we believe that if we have this multi-billion fund without a functioning executive officer separate from the department but reporting to the DG, it seems absurd. So that's what we want to do. The question that came in later in relation to that is, what does it mean? It's your question. What does it mean to be within in the employ of the public service? It's a very good question, because basically the post is created at whatever level a job evaluation process determines. It's not necessarily a DDG level, and both of these jobs may be at a different level, and that will follow both job evaluation processes as well as market-related considerations. So both of these posts are there, advertised, new person, dedicated responsibilities, but both of these posts, a person will then be appointed in the public service at a particular level and be accountable to the DG. So you're not creating these posts outside of the department as if they're not related to us. But your question is an interesting one, because one of the things that we're going to be talking through in the meeting of the NSA tomorrow is, how do you manage the dual accountability? If you want an executive officer of the National Skills Authority, that person must account to the chair of the National Skills Authority. But there's going to be some functions in which that person is accountable to the DG, and we need a clear delineation of that function before we finalize the job description and we're getting professional assistance with that. The timeline was the next question in relation to both of those executive authority functions. There's one thing is to finalize the job description and the complexities of the dual accountability and how that will be managed. The second thing is to make sure that in terms of the permissible amount of the National Skills Fund that we can use for the administration of the fund, that we get the regulation urgently through, but I'm hoping to advertise before the end of March. In the meantime, the function is continuing. We've got an acting executive authority for the NSA, and I designated DDG Faraz Patel for that, because he's the only permanent member of staff because he's been seconded by the Department of Education. And the chief director for the National Skills Fund is continuing to run the NSF, but he would like to improve it. Now, the next question from Member Kabai is, why was the DDG appointed acting? The last permanent chair of the National Skills Authority was Dr. Ketsa Mahele. He resigned. An acting person was appointed. When the minister took responsibility from the 1st of November, he, in one of his public statements and in his statement to the House, indicated that he felt during this very difficult transition it would be important to bring the National Skills Authority very close to the department by appointing the DG as the acting chair in order to really ensure alignment. So I think that we've done a huge amount of work in the last few months that I've been acting, but in accordance with the commitment of the minister, we're now making a new appointment, and that person will provide advice to the minister on how to perform it. I actually think that the NSA and myself think it was the best thing to do, because the NSA needed to be brought very directly into a dynamic relationship with the department. In terms of monitoring the work-based skills program, I've already indicated that I don't think that the work skills program are an adequate mechanism for determining scarce and critical skills. And there's many jocular remarks that are made in the department, one of which will amuse the committee, is that one of the scarce skill lists that arises from that process indicated that there's a scarce and critical skill of politicians, and we were short of about 2,000 in the country. So some of the stuff is in fact just not very very thorough. So the work skills work-based skills programs are not an adequate mechanism for linking to scarce and critical skills. There is a project that we're going to be taking forward this year. It was discussed in a strategic session with the minister, but I doubt that we've had time with all of the volume of work on the hands of the few people in the department to take it forward yet. We will want to do a review in terms of both an employer and labour's perception of ways in which the WSP can be improved. The next question that also comes from Member Kavai is a question of pumping money into sectors where there's no skills needs. There are areas in which there are particular skills challenges, but one must also remember that those skills challenges often are occupationally determined in terms of an occupational framework. Like, for example, a frequently utilized one is engineering, but you get engineers that are working across different sectors, so you need to look at occupations as well as sectors. But there cannot be, in my view, and that must be something that we need to debate, a perception that there's no sector with no skill needs. There's some that are more urgent. But every skill, every sector needs to promote skills development at different levels, whether it's at levels of low skill or high skill. That's the purpose of the skill development legislation and the strategies that we have in place is to enhance skill performance. Since the National Skills Fund, that's the sixth question, is whose question was that? Why are we appointing a CEO? I think I've already addressed that. But the second thing is what's happening out there. I don't know who asked that. What's happening with the National Skills Fund? I think what's happening in terms of the National Skills Fund is that unfortunately there was for a period of several months a suspension of suspending in the National Skills Fund because the DG of Labour did not consider himself to be the accounting authority or the money to be in his budget. And that has had a serious consequence for service delivery. In terms of the skills development planning units, I think that might have been somebody's question, is that the skills development planning unit, in terms of the development of this within the Department of Labour, was absorbed within a general planning unit of the Department of Labour. We believe that the weakening of that intention in the legislation had a significant consequences for the functioning of the NSA in particular. And in the strategic plan, which we're busy finalising to table before Parliament on the 2nd of March, we are resuscitating the notion of a skills development unit, but, and I want to go straight into the question of alignment, which was I think, your question, I'm not sure, is that we need to have alignment between the research capacity and long-term planning of human resource development in South Africa with the National Skills Development Strategy. And the Skills Development Planning Unit, the purposes of which were outlined in the legislation that are tabled, has to be a critical linking point between HRD and NSDC. If the, in conjunction with the Planning Commission, you've got a notion of the human resource development goals of the country and the trajectory of development across, I'm going to have to stop and blow my nose unless people don't mind me sniffing. What, should I blow my nose? Okay. Human resource development strategy is going to be informed, for example, by industrial policy, rural development policy, technology policy. All of those things are going to frame the long-term trajectory. The national skills development, if you can understand how important it is, that strategy, which is a shorter-term strategy of 5 years, is absolutely critical because it takes its resource base of the skills development levy and directs how CETUS and the NSF must use that money to achieve the 5-year plan. that's why this the new department was such an exciting place to be, because it brings these things together that were previously separated. And I'll come to the point about driving it then through public institutions. So when will you see this alignment? The National Skills Development Strategy 3 is going to be presented in terms of its principles to the April meeting of the National Skills Authority. And we are going to then go into intensive consultations within each sector to see how that National Skills Development Strategy can be taken forward and with what kind of targets with each of those sectors. It's also going to be taken forward in constituencies. We're going to be engaging labour and the various components of the broad labour movement, as well as with business, and the minister is intending to have a high-level skills roundtable prior to the skills conference, which will launch National Skills Development Strategy 3 in August. The HRD Council, in the 30th of March, is going to receive the draft HRD strategy. And what we have to do is to say, look at the HRD strategy, where are we going with NSC3, how are these aligned? So I hope that answers. The question of the audit in terms of it being an in-house outsourced thing, in terms of alignment with King 3 principles, all of the CETA boards should have audit committees, but the formal audit of the CETAs happens through the Auditor General's office, because that's it's PSMA managed and it's state responsibility. So all of the language that's used to describe the financial weaknesses for those four performing CETAs are the kind of language that's used by the Auditor General, the qualified audit, and I suppose that all is compliant with generally accepted accounting practice. Very important question about what's the relationship between the suspension of the chair of Max CETA and the financial statements. In fact, when you get the detailed report of the performance of CETA's finance governance, you'll see that there are interesting patterns, is that the financial performance should be unrelated to the suspension of the chair. If you've got a well-functioning CS, good administrative systems, whether or not the chair is suspended for particular allegations, the institution should be functioning. But such is the notion of governance, that weak governance, weak administration often affects each other. And so you'll see those patterns in the detail that we give you. 3 minutes. Okay. Okay, the last one then, I'm answering 3 questions, and I think I nearly got to the end, and most of the questions that I haven't answered I've alluded to in some way, is the use of the National Skills Fund to finance the FET sector. It's an absolutely important question. Now, firstly, let me just say that the principle with which we approach usage of money within the National Skills Fund is that it has to be guided by the current National Skills Development Strategy as amended by the Minister's priorities, which went into the service level agreement requirements. But secondly, it has to be consistent with the purposes of the Act. So that, and then the DG has power. So it's very important for me, as the person who finally has that responsibility in terms of the legislation, to make sure that as we approach the National Skills Fund, we take decisions that we believe would receive the support of the key constituencies, that both business and labour would say, yes, this is consistent with the purposes of the National Skills Fund. So if we use the National Skills Fund to, for example, which I don't think what you suggested, fund ongoing operational costs like employing lecturers, that's enough. I'm saying I certainly know that you're not. But we are trying to realign the skills levy funding to be much more orientated towards the delivery arms of service provision of colleges and universities. And there's a variety of ways in which we're doing that. And I don't want to give too much away before the budget speech, but that is absolutely driving us. Thank you, Chairperson.
No, can I... possibly before members go for a second round of follow-up. I think I want to come back to Member Fukuza's point. I think, DG, for me, the issue is, if the request relating to overview mandate analysis, efficiency challenges, it therefore means also activities. And that's where the details come in. Because the strat plan and when I'm saying activities, I'm talking broadly. I'm not saying, for example, this little project in that area, that area. So you can't, I think it's not a theoretical, the mandate in its narrow sense, then. It's actually the impact of that mandate on society that matters. And that's where I want to come back to Mvukuso that raised that point, because you responded very directly and said in the strat plan and in the budget, you'll see, but that's forward-looking. We're dealing actually with the current and the historical situation. So I thought I understood what you said, and I think actually it made sense. Now, after all being said, after the last 2 hours, the issue is this responding to this thing about the skills crisis that we've got in South Africa? And I'm not so sure if we can make that assumption currently. We've got matriculants last year. Possibly a very direct question would be if you have in 2009, it's 550,000 matriculants roughly, of which 300,000+ has passed, and the rest have failed. So you've got between grade 1 and grade 12 people that's really struggling, and they became average. So they did not go to any university. What is our response? Not in theory, but in practice. What do I say to my constituency when there is 1,000 matriculants out there that has gone through the system of education and there is no program delivery, but there is a budget of underspend? How do I bring these things together? So because at the end of the day, we are members of parliament in service of our people. And I'm not so sure if we are answering that central issue. So with that, if we say the National Skills Fund had the point that you've made earlier around they've left the point about the NSF capacity to implement. They've left the department without provincial capacity. There's an assumption that there was capacity. However, it doesn't reflect that in terms of its delivery in implementation of projects that until in the last few years that there was actual capacity. Because if we are saying that we've taken over a new responsibility, the Department of Labor have... Shona? You want a break? I'm glad for your innovation. At least you've got some serious skills at the level of air conditioning and so on. Funny. Yeah, she's fearing that she's going to get that as well. So the point that I'm raising, if we are saying that there is a capacity problem now, we assume because of the transfer there was capacity before the time. I'm saying I don't agree with that. And the reason why I don't agree, because there's not an alignment between the NSF officials as it was in the Department of Labor and the actual implementation and impact on the ground vis-a-vis budgetary spend. So that's an area of grave concern. Also, if one and something that's very real, DG, we went to Limpopo on an oversight visit. We then send documentation, both through Parliament and directly, on what is the intervention at the level of Limpopo vis-a-vis Giyani, because we were there. How do we go back to Giyani, and what is there for the interventions made, not into the future, but in the existing environment as of November of last year? When one deals with I was one of those people that also believed that all sitters were just bad. And I've also been converted. But I'm actually thinking we should contain our conversion to that point. Because it's as if getting into the system, both in Parliament through this committee and it seems to me in departments, we're starting to understand the problem and we're actually starting to accept that problem. And I'm concerned that we're starting to accept that problem.
No.
Exactly. Because if our perspective was, before we arrived here, through our analyses, that there's actually a very big problem in the seat environment, if we therefore get to the conclusion that there is a big problem based on financial performance issues with four seaters, then it's a narrow process. And I'm not saying it's a DJ, I'm saying I made the example of myself even in that space. Hence, if we go on the performance, because performance cannot only be related to finances, because the finances impact on programs, the finances impact on projects, and impact on society. Out of the 19 that's remaining, a deeper drill into the 19 will give actually very interesting features. And when somebody raised the point about the SWOT analysis, I think, again, it was you, remember, Vukuza. That SWOT analysis, I think, not only becomes the responsibility of the department, but this committee will have to find ways of responding to that. Because the department in its very nature will have to deal with the technical detail, but we've got a responsibility. How do I tell my constituency tomorrow why, in fact, we were in the Northwest the other day, and the seaters are doing work in the Northwest, and I can say it in all provinces, but not in alignment with the provincial government. Alternatively, not in alignment with the strategic thrust, with what we would call the integrated development planning and the growth and development strategies of provinces. Now, clearly, that's a problem. The response that you'll find from those various seaters would be simple. They are sitting on the skills forum in the province. I know that skills forums in provinces does not really exist, and if it's there, it is not really. It's a very junior official in the province that, for example, will chair that skills forum. Because if we can, and that brings us to the year of action, if we can get it right to deal not only with the futuristic stuff, but in fact some of the real issues right now. I think the minister has at some stage announced the 500 million rand on what was that? Yeah, but this is for this, it was for, not like, yeah, that's what I'm saying, it's not futuristic. Obviously, some of the money will continue into the future. But if you are then saying, meaning that was announced last year, so if you just take that 500 million rand, DG, and if you just take the unemployed matriculants as now, and if you actually look at the projects being implemented, then the question is, under our own watch, are we managing and implementing some of that? Meaning, what would be the proportion of that 500 million rand to Limpopo? What would we be able to tell Limpopo based on our intervention we were able to deliver? It's that level of detail. Because can we go back to Limpopo and again just hear them out, which I think we don't want to do. issue around the 19, or in fact, all of the sitters, and that's why I thought one would have had a kind of a comprehensive, if you in fact know that this was the money spent collectively by sitters over the last 2 or 3 years, what number of learnership has been created through that, and with these individuals? Are they actually working, or are they an opportunity? But if you take any of these sitters, in fact, the other day we were engaging the mining sitter. What is it? MQA. Mining Qualifications Authority. And they explained to us that in the Northern Cape, where there's mines, and that can go for the Northwest and a few other provinces, not really the Western Cape. But in the MQA was telling us that 50% of that money, of them, would go directly back to levy-paying companies. The other money, and then there's a 20% and so on and so on, would go somehow for discretion, and training providers from those provinces are actually benefiting through projects implementation. So when the CEO then said that, we drilled down deeper, and it came that it's the training providers set up by the Beers and others that are also benefiting from the discretionary opportunities. Now I'm saying drilling down at that level, we're going to have interesting features. Meaning the opportunity not based on vacancies only, but even that opportunity of a 1 billion rand industry with 500 million rand discretionary somehow are then skewed to big industry. And we then have to change that, because how do we in fact develop the SMMEs? How do we develop broad base? If we do tomorrow an analysis based on every province about CETAs collectively spent, what is that spent? And what is that spent in the context of, I think the minister raised it in the past, rural development, but I want to provincialize it even in terms of provinces, and then in terms of the various strategic areas that government, through SANA and others, has identified. Now, I'm saying those are the complex issues that I'm interested in. There's no way, and that's the detail, and that's why my uncomfortability in the beginning. Because that where I'm sitting, DG, is not the answers that you'll be able to give us in totality today. That level of detail, if we are starting to drill down and ask those questions. Because it's the questions, at times operational, more to your NSF or, what is it, CETA coordination individuals, not necessarily, for example, at the highest level. Because that's where we therefore don't disagree at the level of strategy, at the level of the mandate, at the level of the broad stuff, but the issue is in its operation. And so I'm raising those points and possibly would want to get a glimpse of responses before I allow the members. Just from the DG on some of those things, because my assumption is there's a problem. There's a big problem on skilling. If I read the minister's statement before the minister became the minister, I remember I wrote some document around apprenticeship and trade and all of that before I got into a portfolio like this years ago, 3 years ago. If you, on your own account here, is saying that your own analysis before you arrived, then obviously you possibly, there would be quite some interesting documents to that effect. Are we conforming? That's the question that I'm putting here, and how do we pull ourselves out of that, and actually are able to tell our provinces and our unemployed matriculants or people that have failed that in fact yield these opportunities based on real money that is not being spent.
Thank you very much, Jefferson. I hope you'll give me 4 minutes to respond. You see, I think you are right that you do need to drill down. But I think in drilling down, the strategic perspective that you've provided has to be the mechanism for drilling. Otherwise, you will get lost in detail. So you could have invited today 23 seats of people and they would have just got lost in the morass. But you're asking key strategic questions. I think the department must work with you to work out together what are the strategic questions, and then we've got to drill down analytically rather than... yes, you are correct. Now, the first point you made, I just absolutely... I think it's at the heart of all of this. Because you say there's a skills crisis, and what do we say to our constituencies? What are the dimensions of this thing? What do we say to young people? So many young, I mean, you know that the figures in terms of young people who the acronym these days is NEET, not in education, employment, or training. The number of young people who are NEET between the ages of 18 and 25 is close to 40% of young people in that age group, and we all know that. But you see, I think that why that's an important question is it's precisely why this department has been established. Because the previous separation of some of the skill development strategies from the delivery of education and training has created the schism. And that's the central question of what we've got to address. There's a little bit more, but that's fundamentally the central question. So if you look at your some of your later comments in terms of private providers, one of the things that struck me very early on in this journey of learning with this exercise is that because you've got all of the skills development strategies located separately from the providers of public education, one of the consequences and unintended consequences of the last 15 years is it's generated a massive industry of private provision. The skills development legislation has had very little impact on public providers. That we've got to realign. I'm not saying that private providers are not important and have a particular and have particular niches, but in fact, everything that has been done through the private public providers has been done through private. So that the department, I think, has been established to make sure that we can use the system of providing education and training to respond to the needs of young people using the resource that the skills development legislation and then the levy in particular has made available. So absolutely, I'm with you. The second big strategic question that you've raised, and I have to be frank, this question of capacity on the ground is one I'm busy writing the strategic plan to be ready for the second, and it's one of the things that's troubling me the most. In the National Skills Development Act, there's a clause 23 which deals with employment services, which says that one of the functions of the provincial office of the Department of Employment Services is to establish a skills development forum. Now, I don't know enough, but I agree with your assessment that the skills development forums in the province are not working. I need to physically check myself because that's the way I'll be certain. But I understand that clause 23.1b of the Skills Development Act has been assigned to us rather than to Labour, although the rest of 23.1 is assigned to Labour. But one way or the other, we have to have, as the Department of Higher Education and Training, efficient and effective skills structures of some sort that meaningfully connect and support provincial and local government strategies and industry strategies that are decentralized. So the matrix structure that needs to be developed in terms of skills planning is a little bit scary. And at the moment, subject to any potential intervention from the Department of Public Service and Administration, the entire staff of the provincial offices of the Department of Labour remain with them. So this is urgent and pressing and how we take forward that. So I agree with you strategically. In terms of the concrete answer, if you were to return to Giani, I would say that the responsibility of this committee is to do several things. The minister is in instructions to the CETA and to the NSF said you have to prioritize rural. When the CETA SLAs, which are in big files like this, when the committee has an opportunity to review those, you need to be saying to the, where are the rural funds? Because it's CETAs who now, as an important arm of skills development, need to be directing the resources of the skills levies towards rural areas. The second thing, though, that I'm very, very happy about is that we've met with the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, and we've agreed that we're going to be working collaboratively on a skills development strategy for rural development. We're going to be working with a service provider to develop that. And one of the things why I think it's so important is that I think the whole orientation towards skill development, although part of the targeting has focused on rurality and has focused on micro groups, has focused on the unemployed, is that I think that the whole orientation of previous skills development strategies and much of the GIPSA work that's informed HRDSA has assumed that we're developing skills for development policy that's primarily industrial, whereas in fact there's a huge need to understand skills development for rural areas and get away from the urban bias of our skills development strategies.
Any other member? Mashwana? And then I think members can also start making suggestions now. It's not any more questions because we are sitting now with the last few minutes before we excuse the departure.
Yes, can we get the Skills Development Act, please? I don't have it.
Okay, we can follow it up through our office. Makabela?
Okay, sir. How much we're talking about that is unextended? How much exactly we're talking about?
Okay.
Chairperson, it's a little bit of a moving target because there's an income in, for the National Skills Fund, there's an income for the CETAs. Both of those are determined to some extent on their... It's a shifting target in terms of income because it's a percentage always of their employment bill of employees, so it will fluctuate from year to year. The task that we want to conclude by the time on the Minister's budget speech on the 25th of March is to be able to give an indication for CETAs and for the National Skills Fund of the income at the end of the financial year. And not only the balance, but you've also got to look at the committed funds. So if you just look at income and balance, you'll get a disproportionate idea of how much money is available, because some of it is money that's got to be spent in the next months and the next years. So, Chairperson, with your permission, we hope that we'll be able to give that information at the Minister's budget speech.
Okay. Can I? Anyone else?
A follow-up about this, well, like the question was raised, that there was this 500 million. This one, but it's not necessarily committed. And what we needed was an urgent intervention, taking message out to saying these are the concrete steps being taken to deal with the situation, so that those lingering, those confused, frustrated somewhere, who don't know where to go, what to do, who are able to deal with. Unfortunately, the other major challenge is about facilities or your accommodation for students and many other things. And some of these, even on those training institutions, you may not be able to deal with physical infrastructure, for instance. But we've got a challenge also in that class. Regard and whether there's database for all training service providers that we can know that they are on the ground, there is capacity to handle all these issues that we are actually talking about. We may be too ambitious that we have got all these challenges, but we don't necessarily have, like we were saying, skills on the ground to actually ensure that the program gets to be rolled out.
Can I suggest then, TG, that one around Giyani, I think it's not only to ask questions, because we'll do that, but the point is we were there, and then there was a report from this committee down through Parliament to the department. So I would request that possibly we get response on the actions out of that process. I think that's one. And if it can be noted in that way. It's really one where it essentially just gets two or three of the right people to actually do the stuff and things will happen. That's really what it is. Then secondly, I think through that province there was an agreement that there in fact would be, Member Makubele, a skills development discussion between the province, the department, CETAS. So I think if we can get our members from Limpopo with the department, and really it's not always the DG that have to be there, it's really at times just making sure that we pull the people together, the family of skills, into that space. So Member Mashwana, I'm going to look at you, and I'm going to look at Member Makubele and ask that we actually, with the department, deal with that issue. There is no way that we're going to go back to Limpopo and not be able to say how we've intervened at that level. No. Oh, without. then I think we must, because DG, we're grappling with our responsibility as what we define as an activist parliament. Where our role starts and where our role stops. And somehow the difficulty is when members are going to be in their constituencies, they're not saying it's the department. They're saying it's the movement. They're saying we've made all these commitments and I'm already hearing how the integrity of our manifesto is being attacked. And how the integrity of the state of the nation is being attacked. And hence we our responses will be in action. I think if there is a need for an immediate, because we're going to have to program this, around this thing that Member Makubele raised around the project defined this year, not for the future, I think we need to get, I think it's NSF funding, I'm not so sure. We possibly need to get a report on the rollout, but not a report in writing. We need to timetable it and to see can we actually get that unit to report on two issues here. The NSF, the initiative that the minister has thrown out in his budget speech and implementation around that, but secondly the capacitation issue, the capacity that you... I hope, DG, you understood what I said about DOL and capacity. I actually basically said it's possibly good that a lot of... I don't know if you understood what... Because if you actually look at the last couple of years in NSF and capacity and implementation, etc., there must be a lot of dead wood, and most probably it is an opportunity to then effectively intervene and put people up. So the NSF needs to come and report on the capacity, how they will roll out what is existing, but also into the future. Then the last 2 points is, we've dealt, because there was a committee meeting in November in that transfer period of the CETAS, and I sat in the, some of our members had to, so that we don't have another meeting with all the CETAS, that's what we decided in November. So I sat in one or two of those meetings, am I right, Daniela? And at that time there was I remember two distinctive issues early November on CETA. One was in fact the education CETA, around a letter that went both into the public domain, but also to the departments and to the chairpersons of those of the committees, including the ministers. That was the one. The second issue relating to Math CETA. What then happened in that meeting, in fact it happened in this room, with the committee dealing, then it was the trend. It was literally beginning of when we were dealing with the annual reports. We then agreed that there needs to be meetings with the respective structures. And a meeting took place with the education sector CEO, and documentation has come forward, and I need to analyze that. The same with dealt with the math CETA. In both distinctive CETAs, I think there's possibly very strong views, and what we need to do is we need to be able to have that discussion. Because especially when it's map CETA, I am actually asking, after the intervention based on DOL in the past, did the old guard not just reinvent himself in the space? That's the question that I'm asking. Because the administration, when map CETA was put under administration, when a new structure was put together to help them, it was less than 4 months, then it reverted back to what was. And the common denominator was there was a target. So, when you get into this, I think it's important possibly also to possibly get my own assessment and the committee and Labour's assessment that dealt with it historically. The last issue is based on detailed questioning, some of the things that are thrown out, and I'm going to ask that we through the work in this committee, myself, as well as the research and the advisor, content advisor, actually have to sit down and say, how do we analyze all these things? Because if you've got 23 CETAs, you've got an NSF, you've got a department, are we doing enough internally to ask intelligent questions and to deal with things intelligently when we, for example, going to engage the department in order for us to ensure that we strengthen what needs to be strengthened. So what is our own capacity in dealing with some of these issues? Because it is very difficult, it is very complex issues. So for one of that, you've received an envelope from me, DJ. In that envelope, I just gave it, did you give it? There is a in-depth questionnaire. Those ones need to go to the CEOs, and we need to in fact get the response. You'll understand the essence of those questions and understand it needs to pull out. But we will be distributing that, and if there is further questions, I would suggest that in fact Anelia must give every member a copy. If there's further questions that people believe we need to ask, we need to strengthen that through Anelia's office. Give it to me so that I can then sign it off so that it's structured and it's not. And then when we have all that information, that we make proper analysis, Dennis. And I know you are also in a struggle in terms of two committees, so we're going to have to look at what is capacity required. So with that, DJ, thanks. We will be engaging soon on the strat plan, on the budget process. I think it's the 20th, as you said. 20th? Is it now the 25th? The budget, yeah. 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 But it's the 25th. I remember it's the timetable, the 10th, but because we said it's a week at least after you submitting it into the strat, into Parliament. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you, I just kind of said out, way forward, is there anything that you want to conclude there?
Chairperson, thank you. I think it's been a very useful engagement, and I just want to agree with you, last part, that this strat plan is going to be a critical vehicle for you to check if what we're doing is enough. Obviously, we prepare the strat plan for your detailed consideration, and I really am looking forward to engagement because, for example, there may be areas where you say, no, this is not enough, and you want more, and then we will have to amend it. The second thing I want to just say is that I didn't get to the report from Keani, so I'll follow up on that. I apologize that it wasn't received by us. The third thing is that in relation to the concerns about the map CETA, you see, one of the things that I think is a feature of how legislation works in relation to the work of the minister is that it's open to review.
So the legislation says the minister must act, but he must give reasons and he must indicate steps, and then all of that can be transparent here. So if there's no problem in the map seeker, the evidence is going to be here. If there is a problem, the evidence is going to be here. And it's the committee's responsibility to oversee and review the actions that the minister takes in relation to Section 14 of the Act. So we're going to be doing that. Then, Chairperson, you might. But can I just indicate an apology for not being able to bring more people from the department? When I looked at the four areas, it seemed to me that these are areas in which I've been working, and without the necessary detail, I might be able to answer most of the questions. The reason that we can't bring more people is because we've got serious budget challenges, and one of the proposals that I want to put to the meeting is if for some meetings, I'm not sure about the IT capacity of Parliament, that the DG or the DDG who attends can't be supported by official funding cover. Because to fly four or five people down for a broad ranging thing like this is going to flatten our budget, we're going to exhaust the budget before the year is through. But it may be possible for one or two key officials and then some other people by link up. And it just requires careful chairing. Now, I'm not sure if there's precedent for that in Parliament, but I would strongly argue that we explore it.
We can investigate it, DG. The issue really is there's already two requests that were made, that the operational people need to be here. And none of that has happened in the past. So and it can't just be that, because we are actually very selective by not flying people up and down. I think you possibly picked that up as well. But there was very two specific requests in the past based on the agenda, and I think that's really the issue. So it's not, Mr. Conde, good enough to say that we wouldn't be able to actually get one operational person done, so because of just the flight. Okay, let's not analyze that one. Thanks a lot, DJ. Thanks a lot. We'll move over to the next item. You are excused, DJ, no? If you want to. Shall we do a 3-minute break? Okay. constituency, and how do you respond to those things? And is it our responsibility to understand that there's capacity problems? Is it our understanding? I mean, like, remember Makubele, I was in on the issue by saying, now, what is the underspend? Because the reality is there's underspend. Last year we've heard it. This year we've heard it. So we become, we start to understand the issue. But if you go to your constituency, you've got unemployed people. Or you've got people that's not trained. But the law says there's money for training. And there is money for training. So unless we decide we want to be government officials and understand it, then and I want us to be cautious that we're not in that space. Let's then get back to the minutes. Did you receive the draft term program? Okay. Do we quickly just want to deal with that thing? Now, this is a draft, and members study, the reason why I raised is I just identified right at the end. The fact is there was more than once a request for operational people, and I feel that there is a bit of a shouldering because we are sitting with a problem operationally. Not necessarily by the making of the minister, the making of the DG, etc., but the historical stuff. And I think that's been shielded away. That's why I was insisting on that point. If you look at the draft annual, you've got a draft annual report and you've got a program, am I right? Now this, just a question, Anele, this draft annual report, when is that one supposed to be in? No, we've asked for the analysis as well, but that you will give to me. But members, do you have the draft annual report? What I found amiss when we were discussing it, and I've given Dennis a few headings to look into it, I found it just dealt with the regulatory, but you remember there were deep discussions after every other visit or a meeting, etc. We've actually, there's a body here that has reflected on recommendations, and I've requested that there must be a narrative, and I've spoken to the narrative, to Dennis, a narrative not only speaking, obviously this is the minimal requirement that Parliament, I think, would request. But it would be good to have a glimpse over the last 6 months. So I will look into it today and then also forward that to yourself so that you can, if you want to add on, take away, then you'll be able to do it. Remember, James, are you clear? Not really clear what I'm suggesting. You've got this document. Okay. And the problem with where I'm sitting is now this is minimal requirement. So there's nothing wrong with the way it's been presented here. However, I felt that there was such a body of input on the NSFAS, on the visit that we had, on the assessment of what is the state of higher education and training in South Africa through this committee, that I felt there must be a narrative that speaks to that, in a narrative. So that is what we've worked on, I think Friday, when we had a discussion, Thursday or Friday. Now, that's not really required, as they tell me, but I felt it's important that we actually, in our annual report, actually do that. So that's it. And I'm just suggesting that I didn't yet see the final version, so I will see it now, and I will pass it to all members, and you then can input into it by the latest possibly Monday, so that we can rework it for Wednesday. No? Okay.
We have just been complaining about underspending with the department.
Yeah.
We have underspent. 247,000.
Yeah. But you also, it's in the annual report. It's not the underspend in total, but what we've been asked is, I think in the first year, and the work would be able to possibly give, A lot of the requests go through the Speaker's office or through Parliament on if you want to do visit or if you want to do that, etc. Now, remember there was a request that we don't do, that was also minimalistic. So I've actually also highlighted that to the committee support and said, if you can remember, there were quite a few things that we wanted to do, but we could not do it based on the first year. They're trying to, for example, get to a rationale, but I also feel that we cannot have, that's why I'm even suggesting if we can get some research support in, even on the analysis on the CETUS stuff, etc., it really would be helpful, linked to university. Because literally you sit with Dennis there, and you sit with him in a split environment. And you're sitting with a struggle between two chairpersons or two whips trying to get that support. You are sitting with Anela there, so I remember right up front in the committee, I said the capacitation of this committee becomes for me important. And so I do believe we can do justice through the committee process around some strategic research support based on our term, right? Based on the next programs that we've got. That's one. Secondly, we've had a discussion with the WIP, and she will raise some visits that we are looking at. But we do know why we could not spend. It was because there was a curtailing on let's not, for example, do visits or anything. And I think it was they've tried to standardize it, but that's the reality. Because you see, the problem with that is then they'll say, no, you know, you actually just need 700,000 rand. While not taking into account that we have to pull back based on what the decision in Parliament was. So it's most probably important that we actually also, that I write a letter to that effect also. Indicating what we want to do and couldn't because of the decision. But that's where the work, because you're sitting on some of those strategic meetings, you might just make sure that. I think most of the committees possibly have a problem like that. I know that the committees that were able to, for example, fly overseas last year, did it on invitation at times by the entities, the parastatals or whatever else. That's also what I know. Yeah. Okay.
I think just overall, that there's been intentions. I think we've been working closely with the chairperson around a trip, an international trip, and that has not been coming across because every time we try to plan it. Because if it's a three-time for that, it must be approved by the WIPAD as well. So it has been a difficulty that we've been battling with and the approval. At some point, it was an issue that we should not overspend and all those things. But what we had submitted or what we had been working on was a trip for early this quarter. It's a study tour around issues of colleges and all that, but we have not received approval. So should we get approval, because we're working around this week, the intention is to have the team departing on the 6th of March and then returning on the 12th of March. That was the intention, so we're trying to push within that. Because some of the amount would be spent into that trip. But we're still not yet sure if it's still going to happen because there's a three-language within that week that we have proposed. All the weeks actually literally have three-language. The one that we have identified is the three-language for a debate on International Women's Day. We think that we should have some leniency from the chief with the magistrate. So that's where we need to start because it's responsible for quorum in the House. Even before the chair and committees and the speaker approves, he's got to write and approve it for us. So I'm waiting for that process, and then we'll be able to start then with Anneli and them.
Our content advisor has written a note here, and I suspect he thinks that Member Fukuza doesn't know. But it's not addressed to her, it's to me. No? Financial year ends in March. But we know that. It's just a question. What she's saying, the reality is, as is now,
yeah.
If we don't, for example, actually look at it, then there will be that. In fact, there will be an underspend in any case. It's just a question of how much. Dennis, I'm just joking because it's a reminder. Yeah.
No, actually, I was saying it against exactly that. So I'm away. Chair, I don't know. Just maybe I'm preempting you. I don't know. Last year, if we came in the middle of the year, so I don't know what it looks like when it is a normal year in Parliament and how portfolio committees ideally behave. But just getting a sense from our own sense line of questioning to the department, I think that we also have to start behaving the way we ask. So I don't know if this year there's also a stress plan that we need to have, or it comes, I don't know how often, but we need to landscape our own intervention. We need to sit back and say, here is the landscape of higher education, segmented in terms of its markets and in terms of its stakeholders, and then begin to plan so that we know where we're going. You know, I don't know if... So maybe I'm preempting you, but I'm just saying that maybe down the line we need to sort of like pull our ideas together to say, what is the landscape, what do we want, what do we want to achieve by end of next year from who? And yeah.
No, 100%. I think it comes in a time when we... You'd remember we had a strategic, but that was really as we were coming in, a strat plan for the year and a reflection over 5 years. But we did say we need to actually get much deeper into it. You'd also hear me saying that the type of... the way we're positioning the questioning and what is the issue, so that it becomes away from the asking but also starting to delve in terms of our strategic direction that we would want to see taking shape. The member, is there anyone? So can we then proceed on the back of this? Please read the annual. Sorry. Yeah.
Can somebody explain to me on page 8, under 8.3 of estimated of draft what name?
Draft annual report.
Annual report. Estimated costs, and under no catering, we've got costs there, and I don't seem to be understanding them.
By eight. Under 831, it seems to me.
Yeah, estimated costs. Can you explain those? It's written no catering, but there are costs underneath.
No, it's different dates. It's different dates.
Yeah, I want to know what are these costs for.
On that meeting, there was no catering. In that
no catering.
There was catering.
Would have been. Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, can we move away from that now? Okay. Fukuza. There will be even less in the future. Reading some of the letters that's coming my way. Okay. So please look into this. If you feel that there's things that's omitted, please send it through to the secretary. Yeah, the annual draft. No, I want to move away from this point.
I was like trying to emphasize that we depend on you to make sure that it happens during the first week. We don't know how.
Okay, that's another point you're saying. Huh? We are saying the draft annual report is a process to that. Please look into it, make your inputs, give it back on Monday to Anele, or Tuesday morning when you're back. Give it back to Anele, we'll rework it. We will in the meantime distribute the narrative to you as well, just a 2 or 3 pager. By Wednesday next week, then we will adopt the report so that it can go into the system. Is that acceptable?
Yeah.
Okay. That's the one. Then it comes to the point that Member Kubai raised, and I think you want to speak to that issue. Now, there's two things. You suggested dates for a overseas trip. She didn't say the suggested country. I think there was debate in this committee in the past, especially in that first 1 or 2 or 3 meetings. I remember China, Brazil, and 1 or 2 other countries were mentioned. My advice to the WIP was that what we possibly will do is to find something that's a more straight flight, so in terms of the duration, so that you optimize and not like sit for 2 or 3 days through airports. If that principle is fine, then obviously, if anyone wants to speak on that week, the WIP has the responsibility, and myself now, to try and ensure that it happens, whether it's in that week or subsequent to that, but preferably in that week, it's my view. So, member, you wanted to speak on this issue now. Mishwana? Mm. Okay.
My apologies, colleagues. I think the issue is also to highlight that we might not be in a position to take the entire committee. That's the reality. So I hope colleagues would note from here that we are going to take a representation of the committee, but not everybody. And therefore, later we can do it on a rotational basis, that the team that goes now later does not go. So I hope, I just thought that, let me just start there, so that we are clear as the committee.
Okay. Okay, shall we ask the WIP then to reflect on even the type of what we're suggesting in that space? Because I'm hearing the issue about what then would be the criteria. But let's not discuss in that now. Let's get actually a report. And if we should take those decisions before the time, we'll pull people together quickly. Mary Mishwana?
Thank you. I'm continuing from where I left, to say that since this three-week issue cannot be ignored.
Three-line.
The technologies of this parliament. Can we then, if we can't go during the week, we do it, we include the weekend. So that we make it happen. We don't want to have this understanding. Because we put it nicely as balance. There is one going to be understood. Thank you.
But my understanding is that we're not going because there's a possibility of underspend, because I don't mind that, especially because of the rules were set from the Speaker's office or from the chairperson of committees to say that. So I don't want us to, in fact, then I don't want us to go if that would be the rationale of us going. So if we can just, I understand that what you said is that we, when we started, we indicated that we would want to venture into some international experiences. Those things were discussed. It was minuted. What then happened subsequent to that, we were given a instruction, I think it's through the chairs, of chairs that indicate that we would not be able to, in fact, not just in our committee, but generally, and it related to just the stabilization in that first year. We, however, believe that we can make that pitch as we are supposed to go to one or two provinces as well. In fact, I think Member Gina raised with me at least a province that we're supposed to visit before, in fact, based on the student registration issues. So those things are also still relevant, and we will, between myself and the work, we should just make that assessment on those two or three provinces as well. I just wanted to say that there's no misunderstanding on the back of, let's not discuss anything further related to that. Member McVella?
I think if you close it, then it's fine. But
I'm saying in response to the point around underspend or not.
Yes, what I wanted us to agree on is that we have just sought permission from us in terms of the principle, where we should go. That we don't necessarily have to connect and so on to the direct flight and so on.
Yes.
If we could leave it at that.
Okay.
If it happens based on approval, so be it.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, in a way, what will we do? So that work on it
can
conclude, yes.
I think can we accept it in that fashion, Spirit? Thanks a lot. Let's then go to the, there is also a draft program that was submitted to everyone. You've received the draft program. Now this program, we've taken some of the issues that came out of the last that stood over from the last, from 2009, in fact. I don't know if members were able to get it before the time, so you were able to look into this. But you see today we had that briefing from the department. You also, And then there's the subsequent, and I don't really want to go into every details now of every week, but that's really it. What we require is, we didn't, I think, put in initially the date of the budget vote yet on this. because we're actually waiting for confirmation, so that needs to be strengthened. We also need to have a strategic session as a committee. Those things need to be taken into account, but we'll do it subsequent to the strat plan sessions, etc., of the department. So anyone that wanted to make input on this particular program? Member Kabay?
In terms of, I might not understand how it works, but in terms of budget vote briefing, I see that we would have, by the department, by CHE and NSFAS, SACWA and HISA. Where does the CETA fall in terms of their budgets and the hearing? I just wanted to be clear on that one, because I don't see them, and my understanding is that with the new financial aid, the overall width with the department now.
You want to know? Yeah, okay. It's fine. I'll respond to that one.
I just wanted to say that I presume that would happen when a department does the briefing.
Right. That's what I'll say. I'll respond on that one.
Just on the program, Chair, I studied this before I came to the meeting, and I welcome the visit to the Cape Peninsula University of Technology. And I presume that you're getting all the information ahead of time, at least the key bits of information. And the one area that's very critical is accommodation and residences. And be very good for the committee to actually look at that before we actually visit it.
Okay. Look, I think especially the researcher that's going to be and our content advisor, normally what we do in a meeting like this, we actually highlight some of these things. So then when because at times there's a technical notification to the institution. And if you can just have a close watch, especially the research around some of the stuff then that went out, so that, in fact, I've just given the DG now a very detailed letter of certain things that we actually expect. But it would be good if, through the discussions, that you actually note these things, pick it up, and then as we put it out into the agenda or into the letters, that we already know of that. Just a reminder. So the accommodation issue is an issue there. Just before we go, is there any other institution that you think it's of necessity, at least over the next month or two, based on A, the January-February processes at those institutions? Is there anyone else any area that you feel we should, before we go into anything else, just on the point on Member Khadeva?
Yeah, Dr. Chair, I was just in that note, in a short time, that maybe we should be able to take a look at the issue of the CUT and the issue of the investors relevant. And because, you know, there are these looming crises that are also happening there.
Okay.
So that we can be able to respond to it as quick as we can. As some of these institutions have just stopped children to register and close the admin block. So we can be able to intervene as early as we can.
Okay. Thank you, Bella.
We missed the 3rd February, but the whole issue is, even last year, we've been emphasizing the need to meet with SASCO and any other institution that may be operating at that level. They've got their own issues, but they operate in that environment which we're just coming from a distance. And I thought they could share with us quite a lot, including their own strategic transformation agenda processes that we may want to go into. Not just them alone, I'm saying all other stakeholders, but these ones are more statutory.
Can I... Is it on that point? Okay.
Can I just say, as a committee, I wouldn't suggest that we meet with political, you know, organization, because in terms of students, you have the National Students Body that represents all the things with all the, you know, the SRCs and all that. So my preference would be that the committee interacts with that body,
okay,
not SASCO and SADESCO and BASMA and all that, because it might end up compromising the committee.
Member Magazine. Okay, covered.
Yeah.
Didn't we agree that we needed to talk to the students last year? Because I think we did. We said we are talking to all these other except students. You wanted to...
No. I will not write another letter to the student body inviting them here. So the WIP will do it this time. We've done it twice. So there was a bit of disorganization that side. So if I say will not, I'm just trying to indicate. From the committee side, we set time aside. We actually requested them on more than one occasion. You'd remember they then said they were busy planning their strategy to the review board, etc., to the review panel. So we've done all of that. We were actually disappointed that they were not able to come. And then when we got the feedback, we realized even that meeting was a failed meeting that they've attended. So we'll still do that if there's a request that we must.
Sir, I agree that we may not want us to meet them separately.
Yeah.
I think we can take that. But
yeah.
I'm saying
it's
important will be wrong
that
for us
yeah.
to meet these other people.
I agree.
Because they are part of within that sector. They must
okay.
be met. So we may just look at those.
Okay, but there's understanding that this committee has identified upfront that the stakeholders, including the students, will be met. We've communicated that, and it is therefore not the committee that's at fault that the students did not actually present their case here. I think that's the point that I'm making. Anything else on the teachers? I think the point is that the department, because it will come via, but then there will be detailed briefing sessions per CETA, and that is 23 CETA, so that would be, I think, subsequent to the actual budget day. But we'll follow that up as well of how the practice in the past in Parliament took place. Can we then suggest that the institutions to be suggested to go and visit that we'll do some... Do that, and with that, we'll slot and timetable that in as well. Yeah.
I'm hoping that we'll find some time to visit in Free State University. I would want us to do that as a committee,
okay.
So that we've not interacted with the. I think he's one of the people Prof. Johnson was called.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't come, and all those things. But I would want us not only calling him here,
but
going to visit to the institution.
Okay. Can we then suggest that we will write a letter to the department just asking what is the issues and the progress and the interventions made on these institutions that came out of this committee, so that before we actually visit, that we also have a proper filing, because a lot has happened in January and February in terms of some of these areas. Then the minutes, members, there's three. The 18th of November.
Can I request that the minutes be circulated in time? And I'm not saying that, cause I can't remember what had happened, why we did not get this minute and approve them.
Yeah.
Because if minutes are old, it becomes difficult to even remember the discussion.
Yeah.
I went through the minutes, but I couldn't quite remember what was issued.
Mm.
But with the recent one, I was able to say these are the things that needed to improve, especially the ones that I did. I spoke with Annette on them. But the others, quite honestly, it's going to be difficult to quite remember what was the discussion and whether if these things are captured correctly. So if you can just appeal that minutes be circulated, even if we don't see it, because if we get them, but we don't even approve, but you can make notes. You know, on your minister, they will deal with them in the committee. We are able to go back to that document that you've made notes on. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. So your suggestion is that, which one did you, can we actually start with the first one, or is there a feeling that you want to all the others except the last one, you want to adopt? Is that what I'm hearing? Because you felt you want to get the stuff, you didn't get it in time, etc.
Okay, we got them in terms of circulation, we framed them. I'm just saying that when I was going through the minutes, I had forgotten the discussion.
Okay,
that's what is happening.
Okay.
It's not the fact that we did not get them
old
in time.
Minutes.
Yeah, we actually got them in the last meeting, but because we decided the meeting in February, we decided to
Okay,
to today.
Chairman, I studied the minutes in detail, and I would actually formally move that we adopt the minutes for the 3rd and 4th of November, the 11th of November, and 18th of November.
Okay. Is there support to that? Okay. Okay. Which one? Okay. Okay, fine. Can we then, I think we had a second for that one. And then the 2nd of February, and I would want to, I think I've apologized there.
On the 18th one, I'm hoping that, I don't know, the one I have, the minutes, says deputy chair, it's not deputy chair, it's 18th chair. So, that's correct.
Okay, you said there's notice actually that one.
Okay, yeah.
Then the 2nd of February, Dr. James.
You will see that I was not at that meeting, and there are no public attended. And I just wanted to, for the record, say that I received notification for the meeting only by paper, not by email or SMS, the day before, which is why I didn't attend. I've communicated with Anneli, and we've remedied that problem. So the notification comes by paper, SMS, and by email. But that's why I was not there.
Okay. Then the minutes itself, is there anyone that wants to move? It can't be Member Kubai. It can't be me, it can't be you. The 2nd of February. Which one, why can't it be you? Okay. Move. Second. Penamo. Okay. Okay. Cool. So this has been adopted. I think, members, that concludes our business for the day. We then will send the relevant information out. I think you've got a questionnaire there. If there's anything that you feel that's really the drilling down into the thesis, if there's things that you feel we should actually also include, please communicate. I'm just concerned that we are getting a lot of in the air stuff, and unless I understand our role differently, wrongly, then I think it's not being justice done. So thanks a lot, members.